Richard Stone, Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Investment Companies, the British equivalent to the Active Investment Company Alliance, is here, and we're discussing the state of global shareholder activism and more. This is The Navigator. Welcome to The Navigator, where we talk about all-weather active investing and plotting a course to financial success with the help of closed-end funds. The Navigator is brought to you by the Active Investment Company Alliance, a unique industry organization representing the full spectrum of the closed-end fund business, from investors and users to fund sponsors and creators. If you're looking for excellence beyond indexing, the Navigator will point you in the right direction. Today, the compass is pointing us overseas, across the pond to Europe, because my guest is Richard Stone, Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Investment Companies, the British equivalent to the Active Investment Company Alliance. And you can learn more about it at theaic.co.uk. We're going to be discussing the closed-end fund industry over there, some of the similarities and differences, and most importantly, lessons that their business world may hold for us here in the States. Of course, if you want to learn more about the closed-end fund industry here, no better resource than aicalliance.org, the website for the Active Investment Company Alliance. Richard Stone, welcome back to The Navigator.
Hey, Chuck. Good to see you again.
Let's start with a little bit on the state of shareholder activism, because the activist world here has seen sort of fewer battles, but the battles are really all about, you know, can we narrow the discount? And that's not always the way it's been. But in England, well, you have a lot more shareholder activism. It's maybe a little friendlier. I don't know if benign is the right word. It's kind of like, let's all try to steer the ship in a different direction as opposed to let's fight with management, isn't it?
I think I was over in the US last month, and I think to a degree what you said kind of characterizes some of the difference. I think there is a definite sense I get in the US of a greater degree of antagonism. In the UK, I think there is a desire on the board's part, certainly on the you've got to look at the governance structure. So in the UK, each of the individual investment companies has its own independent board with its independent chair, etc. That relationship with the manager is slightly different, and that kind of governance relationship does impact, I think, the approach to activists. But it means that the boards are willing to engage. They're trying to engage with activists. Everybody's trying to close those discounts, which have been at high levels persistently now for sort of the best part of 2 or 3 years in a way that they haven't been for a long time. So, yeah, boards are looking at every tool in their toolkit to try and narrow those discounts. And as you say, the activists are trying to benefit from some of that as well and agitate for change in some cases.
Well, the largest activist investor here is Saba Capital. They are becoming more and more active there. Does that mean that to some extent you might think that the model here, a model where it's let's go after entrenched management, is maybe more likely what you're going to see going forward, even if the more civilized fashion you described is what's been there till now?
I mean, I think you've seen, as you said, there's a number of activists in the UK. Saba would be the biggest now here today as well, for sure. And we saw them try to effect changes at 7 investment companies at the start of 2025. They're ending 2025 trying to go after one of those again to replace the board and appoint 3 of their own nominated directors. I mean, I do think that they're, you know, there's a question as to whether actually what they're seeking to do is take control of the company rather than necessarily just narrow the discount. If you look at Edinburgh Worldwide, and it's really important that all the shareholders of Edinburgh Worldwide do vote their shares so their opinions are heard, and we can perhaps talk about shareholder engagement as part of this as well. But yeah, Saba has trying to replace the board, has requisitioned a general meeting to replace the board, appoint 3 of their own nominated directors. Edinburgh Worldwide has a discount that's less than 5%. Actually, earlier this week, for a brief period, it was trading at a premium. So at that point, you're kind of, well, if this is just about narrowing the discount, hey, the discount's largely narrowed. So, you know, you could theoretically have sold, could question how much, but you could have sold some of your stock at a premium this week. So, yeah, debate. So it appears in their case to be about more than just narrowing the discount. And in their actions in January, they were explicitly saying that they wanted to effectively take control of the board to ultimately then look to appoint themselves as the asset manager over the pool of assets. So I think that is different compared to some of the activism, some of the other activism that we've seen. And just in the last week or two, we've seen activists writing open letters to member boards asking for, you know, strategic reviews, share buybacks or other activity to go on to try and narrow the discount.
And how you talk about shareholder engagement, I mean, how do shareholders respond? Because here, shareholders are notoriously ho-hum.
And I think that was one of the big things, again, when I was over there last month, I think that was one of the big differences was retail in particular. So, you know, the trust, the investment companies that Saab were requisitioned back in January 25, most of them had a very large retail shareholding. And the perceived wisdom was retail doesn't vote, retail isn't going to turn out. And actually, that proved not to be the case. Retail turned out in big numbers. You know, 60, 70% of holdings on some platforms were voted. And we do that. There's retail is heavily engaged. Retail investors in investment companies in the UK are pretty engaged with what they're doing. In the UK, there's a number of structures that are slightly different to the US. We have to recognize we're a smaller market. We're a smaller geographic market. We have a national press. So, you know, people are reading the main daily papers or the main daily websites and stuff. There was a lot of coverage of this, which agitated investors to act. The companies themselves undertook significant investor awareness activity. And in the UK, you can get the details of your beneficial holders from the nominee shareholder quite easily. You basically, under company law, you can request those details and the nominee has to provide them, which then enables the company to contact the shareholders, the underlying shareholders directly, and effectively encourage them to vote. So yeah, in the UK, we were able to get significant retail turnout and people voted, so which was really good. We also have a cap on the amount that the activist can hold without taking over the company. So you can't go above 30% without making a bid for the company as a whole. So once you hit 30%, you buy one more share, you've got to make an offer for the whole of the rest of the company at that share price, which kind of caps out the extent of influence and ownership that an activist can get as well. So yeah, there's a number of things structurally in the UK that make a difference, but it was definitely about shareholder engagement.
I want to go to something else where structurally it's different. One of the things we've seen in the United States has been this explosion of interest in private credit and private equity. Private equity has done it in a number of ways, but we've also seen a lot of activity through business development companies. That would be your private credit side, where folks are lending money to small businesses. In Great Britain, you don't have BDCs, but you have something sort of like them called a venture capital trust. And the reason I want to talk about them is we talk a lot here about programs that would spur investing. But what spurs it there is that these venture capital trusts have tax incentives. How does that work so that people here can sit there and go, wait, I'm investing in a BDC, but I'm not getting the tax benefit. I might be getting all of the risk. There's a better vehicle out there potentially, not for our investors necessarily, but if the government here and if the powers that be wanted to make something that could spur more business activity.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just quickly on the private equity, private debt stuff. I mean, there are investment companies in the UK that do invest in that. So we have a number of private equity investment company funds, private credit, private debt, etc. I mean, they tend to be quite large. But again, if you go to our website, like you said earlier, then you know you can find lists of those and look at those sectors. Venture capital trusts are a sort of unique UK construct, which is designed to crowd in retail money. So the investors in venture capital trusts are all retail. And effectively, they issue shares every year to raise new capital. And those shares issued at par get tax relief, or the investor gets tax relief. At the moment, that's 30%. So you put in $100,000, you would get $30,000 back from the taxman at the outset. But you've got your $100,000 investment sitting there. And any dividends are paid tax-free, so you don't pay income tax on any of the dividends that are paid out, and you don't pay any capital gains tax on any capital growth. So there's sort of combination of those three incentives. And then there are strict rules around what the venture capital trust can then invest in terms of the size of the company. And it's designed to, the rules of the scheme are designed to try and steer capital towards SMEs, relatively new startups, etc. A significant proportion of the companies that VCTs invest in, because they are high risk, do fail. But ultimately, you hope that, and VCTs, venture capital trusts, have a track record of investing in names that have gone on to be big listed companies over time. Yeah, you hope that there'll be a few winners in each of those portfolios such that they outweigh the losses. But ultimately, you're investing, the other benefit is you're investing in that portfolio. So as a retail investor, you're not taking a risk on one particular company or whatever. So yeah, the tax relief up front, as I said, was 30%. The government has literally just cut that down to 20%. So from next April, which is when all of our tax changes in the UK take effect, the tax relief will go from 30 down to 20%. So we're expecting quite a boost to fundraising this year, because it'll be a case of buy them now while stocks last, but probably a significant drop in funding next year. So it'll be interesting to see quite how that plays out. But we'll be agitating for those tax reliefs to be increased again, so that that flow of funding isn't cut off too much.
Yeah, interesting to watch how that outside incentive can change the demand and supply picture, as it were, and what that's going to wind up doing to pricing down the line. That'll be a fun story to watch.
And to give you a flavor, there's about 6 billion sterling invested in those venture capital trusts today, so about $8 billion. And the trusts have a period of time to invest the money. So there are rules around how quickly they have to invest the capital. But yeah, it's a good scheme, and it gets a certain level of interest from overseas, certainly from Europe and the Far East. I know there's been quite a bit of interest in how the UK does that. So it might be something the US authorities want to look at too.
One of the other interesting differences to me is that the AIC, you don't represent interval funds. Interval funds over there are known as long-term asset funds, because they're not closed end, or they're not closed ended, I guess, to use the right verbiage. And as a result, I guess it's no surprise that since they're not represented by your organization, you're not exactly big fans of them. But to me, as somebody who looks at the industry, it's really interesting to watch one side of an industry kind of look sideways at another. There are some things with liquidity that you guys are concerned about with the equivalent of interval funds over there. That's not a problem that's specific to Great Britain. So help us understand why here, where we're seeing a lot of interval fund growth, and there you would be arguing against it.
I mean, just to be clear, we're seeing, so the long-term asset fund is a relatively new construct in the UK, and we are seeing quite a lot being launched, not aimed at retail. So at the moment, distribution to retail is, it's had a number of restrictions around it, but largely in the pension fund market in particular. But yeah, a long-term asset fund in the UK is very much like an interval fund in the US. 5% redemptions, quarterly redemptions, those sorts of things are typical. And our issue with them is that you still have a liquidity mismatch between the underlying investment and the nature of the vehicle. So if a client comes in and they say ultimately they want their money back, well, if more than 5% of the capital's wanted back by investors within a quarter, then they can't do that. So that impacts the liquidity promise that's effectively made to the investor. It also impacts what the fund can invest in, because they carry a certain level of liquidity in order to meet redemption. So they're not necessarily fully invested. That acts as a drag on performance. As I heard somebody put it, ultimately, if we'd had interval funds or long-term asset funds and not investment companies, then somebody would have invented the investment company to overcome the problems that you have with an interval fund or a long-term asset fund, because they're trying to solve a problem, in our view, which the investment company solved 150 years ago, which is, how do you get investors access in a liquid vehicle to an illiquid asset? And we have members in the UK, investment companies, closed-ended funds, invested in infrastructure, renewable energy, real assets, solar farms, wind farms, large infrastructure projects like new nuclear power stations and stuff. They're investing in the real stuff. And the closed-ended company is the perfect vehicle to give investors access to that, because you don't have to worry about that liquidity mismatch. And the market takes care of that in the pricing, in terms of the discounts and things around the price of liquidity and what investors are prepared to pay for that. So, yeah.
And there have been liquidity mismatches in this country They just haven't gotten a lot of attention, but they may get attention in a further or future episode of The Navigator. Richard, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for coming back to join me on The Navigator.
Thanks, Chuck. Really good to see you again. Always happy to come back.
The Navigator is a joint production of the Active Investment Company Alliance and Money Life with Chuck Jaffe. And yes, I'm Chuck Jaffe. Check out my hour-long podcast available every day the markets open by going to moneylifeshow.com or by searching for it on your favorite podcast app. To learn more about closed-end funds, interval funds, and business development companies, go to AICAlliance.org. That's the website for the Active Investment Company Alliance. Thanks to my guest, Richard Stone, Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Investment Companies, the British equivalent to the Active Investment Company Alliance, which you can learn about at theaic.co.uk. The Navigator podcast is here for you every Friday, including through the holiday season. So make sure you don't miss an episode by following along on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back next week with more closed-end fun. And until then, happy investing, everybody.